is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Jonathan Sippis, head women's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. This episode is brought to you by the Ready State Virtual Mobility Coach. Dr. Starrett is a movement and mobility coach for players in the NFL, MLB, NHL, and NBA, plus a doctor of physical therapy. Kelly has created a program called Virtual Mobility Coach. Every day, Virtual Mobility Coach gives you guided mobility videos. It walks you step by step through Kelly's proven techniques to relieve pain, improve range of motion, and improve performance. Try it completely free for 2 weeks, and if you decide to continue, you can get 10% off for life using promo code HOOPHEADS10. Visit thereadystate.com/hoopheads and use code HOOPHEADS10 at checkout. Again, that's thereadystate.com/hoopheads and use code HOOPHEADS10 when you sign up to get 10% off for the life of your membership after your 14-day free trial ends.
Getting to know your players is huge. That's a big deal. You have to know them. They have to know that you care about them as a person and not just as a player.
Special Jennings is in her first season as the girls' head basketball coach at Montverde Academy in Montverde, Florida. Jennings was previously the associate head coach at the University of Illinois Chicago, spending 2 years there from 2018 to 2020. She spent the 2017-2018 season as an assistant coach at Flagler College in St. Augustine, Florida. Before arriving at Flagler, Jennings honed her craft as an assistant coach at Augusta University for 3 seasons. Prior to her time at Augusta, Jennings got her start as an administrative assistant for the women's basketball program at Wright State for the 2013-2014 season. Special stood out as a player, starting 115 consecutive games at Xavier University. She is currently tied for 4th all-time in assists for the Musketeers with 515. Jennings led the Musketeers to an NCAA Elite Eight appearance in 2010, 4 Atlantic 10 Conference Tournament titles, and 3 other NCAA Tournament appearances. Jennings then went on to spend the 2011 through 2013 seasons as a professional player in Finland. We recently launched the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Our roster of shows is growing, so don't forget to check out all our other podcasts on the Hoopheads Pod Network, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, The Green Light, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavaliers Central, Knuck If You Buck, 305 Culture, Blazing the Path, Hashtag Lakers, Motor City Hoops, X's and O's NBA Breakdown, Spanning the Spurs, LA Hoops, The Wizards Hoops Analyst, and At the Buzzer. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Email us info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Grab your notebook as you listen to this episode with Special Jennings, head girls basketball coach at Montverde Academy.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here tonight with my co-host Jason Sunkel, and we are pleased to be joined by the head coach of Monteverde Academy, Special Jennings. Special, welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, how y'all doing? Thank you for having me.
We are doing great. Yeah, absolutely. We're excited to be able to have you on and talk about all of the interesting things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball. Growing up in our hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, we'll go back to that time and tell us a little bit about how you got into the game when you were a young kid.
Ah, man, I got into basketball actually from playing football. And so I played football for Powell 6, all contact, all boy team. I was a starting quarterback as a kid. And I grew up in across the street from my house is a recreation center called Zelma George. And there was a coach that would come there all the time. He was familiar with a lot of the people that worked there, Melvin Burke. And he saw me one day and he kind of asked me who I was and things like that. I kind of ignored him. But I live right across the street from the park. And so he came and knocked on my door, and my grandmother, he asked to speak with my grandmother, and they had a long conversation. And from there, I started working out with him. I started going down to the rec center with him, and it just took off from there.
How did you get into football? So if football led you to basketball, how does a female get into playing football?
Wow. I had a friend back then that was always at the park. And they were the Bird brothers. And they, you know, we had this bet, oh, you can't do this or you can't do that. And I was always the type that I was always up for a challenge. And so tried out for the team. I've always been athletic, so I kind of can do anything, which was weird growing up. And so, man, I tried out for that team, and they saw me throw the football, and I was tough. And it just, you know, it just happened.
So when you transitioned to basketball, what did you like about the game of basketball? What was it that about the game that attracted you to it? Was there some particular aspect of it that you especially liked when you were younger?
No, it just was fun. It was fun. I, you know, when I first started out, we were playing. It was a great way of getting out the house and meeting new people, and so it was fun. I didn't, you know, obviously I didn't take it serious until I kind of became good at it. So, but in the beginning, it was just a way to get out the house.
As a young player, were you mostly playing against boys or were you playing with girls?
Oh yeah, I was with the guys. Yeah. I don't know. I was with the guys in the park on the blacktop on the concrete. I played in the travel league with the boys. You know, I don't know. I've always played with the guys.
Was that because of a lack of opportunity for girls, or was that because of just your ability and sort of makeup as an athlete?
I think it was more so due to the ability that I had at such a young age. There were all types of girls' leagues and things like that, but they weren't as competitive as the boys' league.
So when you started getting into it and you thought, hey, basketball is kind of going to be where I want to spend my time, and you started to get a little bit more serious about it, what did that look like for you in terms of your plan to get better and improve? Was it continuing to play the pickup games and playing travel basketball and eventually playing some AAU stuff? Or were you also doing some stuff on your own, working out with Coach Burke? Or just tell us a little bit about what your summer workouts might have looked like to try to get yourself to be a better player.
Yeah. So, you know, starting out, it was with Burke all the time. We always had some type of work. We used to go down to Lonnie Burton Recreation Center. And you know, it was a lot of kids down there. Burke was actually the director of that center. And so, you know, he coached at East Tech and he had a lot of the top athletes and things like that, coming down there, working out with him. So I got really heavily involved in that. And then, once I started playing AAU is when I knew like it was time to start taking it serious, because on the AAU circuit, there's so many young ladies that are, you know, pretty good. And at that point they started taking it serious. And so I had to, you know, work hard to elevate my game and be able to compete at that level. It was no longer, you know, pick up at the playground or pick up at the rec center. You know, it was serious basketball.
And so when you say serious basketball, just give us an idea of what your AAU situation looked like when you were, let's say, as a middle school into your early high school years. What team were you playing for? How many games were you playing in a summer? What did a typical, if there was such a thing as a typical summer, what did that look like for you on the AAU circuit?
I didn't start playing AAU till the eighth grade. It was, you know, seventh or eighth grade. And I played for All Ohio out of Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, that organization is ran by Johnny Bathea. And so, I would get in the van, you know, car with Burke and with Stovall, and we ride up to Columbus. And, you know, we practice in Columbus, and then we play. And All Ohio was an elite, still is, an elite program, you know, sponsored by Nike. So we played in all of the top events. And so we'd be gone, the whole month of July. You know, your July is gone. You have your fun in June because July is all AAU. And we were, you know, different city, different state every weekend.
What did the transition look like for you in terms of you grew up as an elementary school age kid playing against the boys primarily, and now you get to AAU and your transition, you're playing to all girls. What was that transition like for you? Did it seem, at least initially, was it almost easier because you weren't playing against the boys anymore? Just what was that transition like for you? I'm curious.
It wasn't easier because we played up. So we played against older young ladies.
Gotcha.
So the competition has always been tough. And, you know, as I stated, All Ohio is an elite program. And so the tournaments you're playing in has the other elite teams. So, you know, it wasn't like now. AAU nowadays, I feel like it's so watered down.
For
sure. Because there are so many teams. There's thousands of teams. You know, when I play AAU, you play for, you know, in this state, this was the team. In that state, that was the team. And it was like state rivalries and things like that. Now there's so many interstate rivals that it has watered down the game, because you may have one really, really good player on a team, on every team, and it makes for a bad game. But when I played, there were about 9 really, really good ones, and you're playing against 9 really, really good players. So it was different.
So talk to me a little bit about that difference in the way that sort of the AAU system is set up today. And obviously there's still those elite teams are still in existence, but yet, as you said, it's kind of AAU has sort of opened itself up to everybody playing. Whereas when you played, and I'm an old man, so back when I played, there was basically only the very best players were playing on those AAU teams. And now again, everybody's into it. So when you look at that from a coach, and you can take this from a coaching position where you are now at the high school level, or think about it when you were at the college level, how do you think that youth basketball system that we have in place today, how has that impacted the game positively, negatively? Just kind of maybe give us your feelings about where basketball is from a youth standpoint.
I think for me, and one of the reasons I stepped into this position that I'm in now, I think that the game is not being taught at a level in which, and I'm speaking from strictly from fundamentals. You know, everybody tries to do what they see on TV with the LeBrons and the Kyries and all those things and the street, you know, doing all the things that they do. Little do they know is that they played at, you know, different levels. Steph Curry, you didn't know about him until he had his breakout year at Davidson. You didn't know about, you know, Dame Lillard, or you're not going to even use females. You know, Diana Taurasi and all those players, like you didn't know about them until they got good, got better, got, you know, utilized the fundamentals and things like that to get them to that level. And now, you know, you see kids doing the Euro step, everything. You know, you have a regular traditional layup that you can make, and you turn it into something crazy. And so I think that, you know, at this level and right now, the game from a fundamental standpoint isn't being taught. It's not being taught. Like, kids don't know how to reverse pivot, yet they want to do step backs. And so, like, it's been tough. It's been tough to watch.
Do you think that's because the system today encourages kids just to play games because of the business side of it, where there's a lot of money in tournaments, there's a lot of money in running teams, and as a result, there's not as much money in running practices for those teams? So do you think that's part of it, is just the fact that our kids are playing, you know, in some cases 50, 60, 70 games in a summertime when you go and you're playing every weekend these tournaments?
Yeah. And see, like when I play AAU, we practiced. Like there was practice. We practiced. And so now, like you said, these kids are playing so many games without the practice. So they're getting seen without being good. You know, when I was on a collegiate level, it's almost like if I've already seen a kid and when I saw them, they weren't good, you know, naturally someone's going to say, hey, this kid, I'm already say, hey, listen, I've seen that kid play already, you know, and they're not that good, as opposed to getting good and then getting seen, you know, right. So it's super backwards.
So if you could wave a magic wand and fix one or two aspects of the current system that we have, and again, you can look at this from whichever coaching perspective or maybe even from a playing perspective, how could we make it better? What's one or two things in your mind that you think would make the youth basketball system that we have today, what could make it better?
Stop hiring Uncle JoJo and Cousin Pete and Cousin Roberto to run a team who has no basketball knowledge of any sort. Obviously, kids are playing for, you know, their parents, and it's just, you know, people without any type of knowledge of the game. You know, I'm not talking about knowledge of, oh, you know, I know what a travel is. I know what a carry is. I know what a, you know, there's more to it than just that. And when you know, you're just out there, because a lot of these teams, you may have someone, a parent that has a good kid. It's like, well, I'm going to build a team around my kid, as opposed to like allowing your kid to go develop and go get good and go play with other people that's competitive, that's going to push them. You know, that's just a big problem. That's a big problem. There's a lot of coaches with no credentials on that level. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Do you think that we could, and I know this is something that USA Basketball is really pushing for with their coach certification, but I think it's a really challenging, it's just a challenging environment out there when you think about the number of coaches that are required, which goes back to what we talked about earlier, where AAU is watered down. You have so many kids that are involved in it that there's only so many qualified coaches out there. And I feel like that if you get to a good program that provides at least some degree of coach training, even if you just run a quick clinic and say, hey, here's how you organize a practice, or here's how you relate to kids. And so much of coaching, especially when you go down to the younger ages, is, yeah, you've got to be able to know basketball, but you see, and I'm sure you've seen it as a college coach and you've seen it with the amount of experience that you've had out on the AAU circuit. I mean, you see a lot of bad coaching, and not even necessarily bad basketball coaching, but just bad human interaction of trying to, you know, coach kids in a way that I don't think is conducive to helping them to love the game the way you loved it, the way I grew up loving it, the way Jason grew up loving it, where it's just like, that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to go play. And I attribute a lot of that to the way that my family handled my situation and the way that my coaches encouraged me to play. And it sounds like, you know, you had Coach Burke who kind of watched over you and encouraged you to play and saw and nurtured your talent. And I just think that coach training is such an important part of it. And when you have, as you said, a parent coach or an uncle's coming in or coaching, or you have a parent who isn't qualified, but their son or daughter is a really good player. And so then they say, well, I'm going to coach the team because my kid's the best kid on the team. And then everybody else kind of misses out on quality coaching. I think that it's a challenge, but I think coaching certification could be a way that we could handle that. And I don't know if you do it again with USA Basketball or you do it on a smaller scale with these individual AAU programs. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a smart way to kind of weed certain scenarios out. You know, last year I was at an event where you see, I think these coaches are doing less coaching and more screaming at officials,
yep,
you know, than paying attention to their kids and things like that. Or, you know, a call may have happened here, but, you know, just not really paying attention to the game. And so it's just, yeah, I think being certified just means that you have to go through a few steps. And if that pushes you to have to learn a little bit about the game or kind of, you know, study the game, I think, you know, you have to be certified to be an official.
Right, exactly.
Why wouldn't you have to be certified to be a coach?
Exactly. You know?
So,
yeah.
So it's definitely a challenge. And I definitely think there needs to be some change because it's just getting out of control. You've seen more and more altercations at events now. You see more and more kids, you know, talking back to coaches, or more and more kids fighting. You see more and more kids hopping teams. You see more and more kids in the transfer portal. Like, it's just all of it is a direct correlation to you know, kind of how you go through the game.
Do you know where to hit the backboard for the highest percentage shots? Do you know when using the backboard is better than taking a direct shot? Be certain that you are taking the highest percentage shots by training with the Shoticle. The Shoticle mounts on your backboard to give you the location of the highest percentage shots. Train with the Shoticle and you will score more. Basketball is a data-driven game, so don't ignore the data and the facts. We worry about the data so you can focus on shooting. Visit Shoticle.com now and start scoring more. Yeah, I'm going to make 2 points based on what you just said. And I think it's a great, great statement that you just made about just making sure that coaches have that training that they need. And one of the things that I've seen when it relates to players and just the behavior of players and coaches and people jumping around and skipping teams and having issues within games. Obviously with COVID now, you've done away with the post-game handshake. And at least where we are, we're kind of like waving at the other team.
Right.
And in a way, as a coach, part of me feels this sense of relief that, oh, I don't have to worry about what's going to happen as my players go through the layup, you know, go through the handshake line that somebody, I mean, I can count a number of times that my team's gone through the line, win or lose. And after they get through the line, they come back to me and they say, hey, coach, player X said this to me when we walked by, or player X pulled their hand away. And those are things that, look, they're kids. Sometimes those things happen. But a lot of that comes from the leadership at the top where, as you said, they're screaming at officials or they're doing this or they're doing that. And I think that's something that we should be able to fix without question just by, again, giving coaches more training. And if we were to do that, I think we'd end up with a better product out on the court for sure.
Absolutely. 100% agree.
Let me ask you about your recruitment. As you get into high school, obviously you have a tremendously successful career at Lutheran East and you start to look around the landscape and you had a lot of success from the time you were very young. So when did college basketball kind of get on your radar as, hey, I'm pretty sure I'm going to get an opportunity to play college basketball? And then just talk to me a little bit about what the recruiting process was like for you and ultimately making the decision to go to Xavier.
Probably 10th grade for me is when I was like, okay, this thing is serious and this can definitely be a vehicle for me to get an education, a free one at that, and kind of compete at a higher level. You know, I knew that I had to get some sort of scholarship. I'm very smart, though. I had great grades and things like that. So whether it been academic or athletic, it had to be either one because my family would not have been able to pay for me to go to school. So, you know, definitely 10th grade, you know, like I said, playing for All Ohio, we're traveling, we're getting seen by a little bit of everyone. You know, so that was like, I was like, okay, I got to buckle down. And in the recruiting process for me, I guess in the 9th grade, I kind of like, I always knew like I was going to Ohio State, which is like a thing, like, oh, I'm going to Ohio State. But, you know, once you start, you know, you grow up, you mature a little bit, you start really understanding the process and understanding, hey, you have to go somewhere that suits you, somewhere where you can not only be successful, you know, athletically, but of course, academically. Just for me, I always wanted to go somewhere where I can, you know, create my own legacy, build my own legacy, not go and be in someone else's shadows or, you know, when I'm playing, I have to hear, you know, the comparisons of someone else that has already come and done and gone. And so that was huge. And so, you know, when Xavier popped in, I had a couple people that I knew from AAU that played for the family. Amber Harris, Tashia Phillips, we had played against them several times over in Indianapolis. And, you know, Amber Harris was a year older than Tashia and I, and she ended up going ahead and committing to Xavier and just talking to Tashia. And, you know, we kind of, to me, in the game of basketball, to be really good, you just need a triangle and everything, you know, and roll everyone else to fulfill their role. And, you know, knowing that, okay, this will be a great triangle. You know, this is a huge triangle. And what they had already had there at Xavier, I knew that, you know, man, I can come here and really make my own mark, do my own thing. You know, the school had made an Elite Eight in I want to say, oof, it had been a while. It was when Amy Wall played. They actually had beat Tennessee to go to the Elite Eight. But, you know, it hadn't been anything done in a decade or so. And so, you know, again, when I got there, Kevin McGuff, met with him, met his wife, met the rest of the coaches on that staff, and just the atmosphere at Xavier. You know, I had a feeling. I called Xavier after I came from the visit. I was on my flight. When my flight landed, I called Kevin and committed, you know, because that just the feeling I had when I left there was like, wow, this is it. And so that's how I landed there.
That's very cool that it came to you, you know, that clearly that you had that strong of a feeling that when you were there. And I think, you know, it comes down to, you know, you got to have a fit with the coaching staff. Obviously, you got an opportunity to meet the players. You had an idea in your mind of kind of wanting to forge your own path and be able to have an opportunity. So when you get there, what's the adjustment like for you both on the basketball floor, academically, and socially going from high school to college? What was the transition like for you?
Well, it was different because two of the coaches that was on that staff were no longer there when I got there. Tasha Pointer was, she was an assistant at Xavier, and then she had moved on and became an assistant at Rutgers. And then Mike Bradbury had become the head coach at Morehead State. And so the staff was different. that's the first thing. So just that adjustment to, you know, kind of getting to know, you know, the new assistants and kind of say, hey, you know, I signed up with these coaches and, you know, kind of just making that adjustment. But, you know, the great thing is that, like, again, Kevin is phenomenal and he brought in great pieces to the puzzle in Carla Morrow and Mike Neighbors. And, you know, we had what I would consider a dynamic coaching staff. And so the adjustment was fairly easy from that standpoint. As a player, I think when I first got there, I had the everyone was against me mentality. I had the I have something to prove mentality. And what that made for was me being uncoachable. And so those first seven games, I think, of my career, I didn't start. And I think that was my wake up call to say, hey, you know, you don't know it all. You don't have it all. These people are not, you know, they're not after you. They're here to help you kind of sit back, listen, take it in, learn, and do what they're saying, so that I can grow. And I think that was the best thing that had ever happened to me was Kevin not starting me, you know, in those first games when I got to Xavier.
So what did that look like in terms of your attitude, your behavior during that initial period that made it so, hey, I'm not starting, and then you flip the switch. So what was different about your day-to-day interactions or the way you went about your business once that light came on for you?
Oh, it was horrible at first. I mean, yeah, think about it. I'm a kid coming from Cleveland. You know, I'm this, I'm that, state this and all this and that and recruiting and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, I felt disrespected at first, you know, for lack of better wording, because I felt like, man, I've worked, you know, I know that I'm suitable. This is, you know, I should be starting. And, you know, I had that going on. And so, again, it took me getting out of my own way and realizing that, okay, what is the reason he's not starting me? Let me scale back and figure out why he's not starting me. There's a lesson in this. And so once I sat back and got that lesson of, hey, you're not being coachable. You think you know it all. They say zig, you zag, you know. So just I had to get on the same page. I had to get on the same page.
So that's a pretty mature response for someone who's 18 years old to kind of be able to self-analyze that. So was that something that you came to on your own? Was that something that you talked with a teammate, with Coach Burke, with somebody else
coaches,
in your life that
man,
you trusted?
The coaches? On the staff. Yeah, okay. So that's how I think that's why Carla Morrow and I are so close, and her and Amber Stocks as well. You know, again, I didn't understand it at first, and man, I despised them at first. And I was like, this is not it. This is not what I signed up for and all those things. But, again, once I bought into, you know, what they were telling me, we had our side conversations and I was in the office and I really wanted to understand what was happening. And Carla and Amber did a phenomenal job of putting the facts in front of me. And I mean, obviously, as an 18-year-old, it's a hard pill to swallow to say, hey, you're not cutting it. What you're doing is not going to get you anywhere anytime soon. You know, but, you know, there's a lot of people that's in my same situation. It's just you have to have those people in your corner that can break it down to you in a way in which you understand. But you also have to be receptive to the information. And, you know, so it works two ways. And I was fortunate enough to get out my way and become receptive and, you know, turn the corner from there.
How have you used that experience that you had as a player, as a coach? Because obviously, I'm sure you've run into, over the course of your coaching career, players who are in a similar position to what you were in, where for whatever reason, they're not seeing that whole picture. So how did you use your own experience, or how do you use your own experience as a player to be able to convey those messages to the players that you're coaching?
Oh, it's kind of the same way my coaches did it, you know, kind of got to know me off the court, you know, so getting to know players outside of basketball, outside of the gym, because, you know, I was not bought in because I didn't believe that they believed in me. You know, I didn't believe that they were, you know, they understood special to person and, you know, not just special to player. And so I always want to make sure that I know my kids outside of the gym, because life happens. And a lot of coaches, I think we fail to realize that, you know, whether it's high school kids or, you know, college kids, 18 to 22 year olds, life is still happening to them and they're trying to adjust to that. And a lot of times they don't know how to. And so all that negativity or whatever it is that's going on in their little bubble, you know, they bring that to the gym, and, you know, that can positively or negatively affect them. And so getting to know your players is huge. You know, that's a big deal. You have to know them. They have to know that you care about them as a person and not just as a player.
All right, I want to dive into that a little bit more, even though I know we haven't quite got to your coaching career. I think this is a great point to be able to dive into a little bit more. So how do you go about, and maybe it's different as an assistant coach, maybe it's different at the college level from the high school level, but just maybe give us a quick overview of how you build those types of relationships that you're talking about with your players. Is it something that is done on a formal basis where you set it up and you have a meeting or a breakfast or a meal or take a walk or whatever it is, and you do that on a regular schedule? Or is it more organic, where something comes up and you're sending a text, or you're just talking to players while they're doing their stretching, or you're having them stop in the coach's office during school? Just tell me a little bit about how do you build those relationships like you're talking about?
It has to be organic. You know, some coaches try too hard. You know, if you're setting it like as if it's a meeting, you make me feel like I'm in trouble. You know, like,
yep.
It has to be organic. You know, like something as simple as, hey, what's up? What you do today? You know, what's going on? How your mom? How your brothers? What you know, just getting the little things. And you know, naturally people will open up when they want to open up, but you have to give them a reason to open up to you. And so forcing relationships does not make for a good relationship. It has to be something that's natural. They say, hey, you know, coaches, she's serious on the court, but I know that I can go and talk to her about anything, whether it's, you know, hey, my mom really ticked me off today, or, you know, whatever, my partner, my boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, it has really upset me, or I'm mad at my sister, or, you know, whatever it may be, for them to be able to have those conversations with you outside of basketball. And, you know, it don't have to always be in your office. Walk, take a walk with them, go get some ice cream, go, you know, different things to where it's not always in the gym.
Is that easier or harder to do as an assistant coach as opposed to being a head coach, or is it just different?
I think it's different. You know, I think it's different. I just think it's, again, kids are going to gravitate who they gravitate towards. And whether you're the head or the assistant, you know, it's just who they click with, you know, their comfort level with you. So it's different, you know?
Makes sense. All right, let's jump back and wrap up your playing career. Give me one or two of your favorite memories from your time playing college basketball, and then I want to talk a little bit about your time playing professionally in Finland.
Probably my one of my favorite memories is making it to the Sweet 16. And I say that, I don't even say our Elite Eight and all that stuff, because the Sweet 16 was the moment we got over the hump. And so for that, you know, that for me was, you know, the previous year we were supposed to make it and we end up losing to Gonzaga. And then that next year, lo and behold, who do we play? Gonzaga. And we ended up beating them. And it was just like, it was almost like kind of like a weight lifted off your shoulder, like, ha, you know, because they were very good. You know, Courtney Vandersloot, one of the best point guards I've ever played against. And she's still, to me, in my eyes, one of the best. Still doing it, plays with Chicago Sky. You know, she's phenomenal. She's smart. Her IQ is super high. You know, her attention to details, the way she played the game, she played the right way. You know, she has like a Steve Nash kind of feel to her. Just phenomenal player. And so, you know, again, when we played them and got over that hump, that was like one of the best moments for me in my career.
Yeah, that's very cool. Those memories that you have that stick with you, and when you have something that as a team and as an individual that has kind of been on your radar of like, hey, we gotta get this done. We were supposed to get here the previous year. Now we do. We get over that hump. And those are things that, again, I'm sure you know, will stick with you for the rest of your life. And so basketball is obviously, for anybody who's listened to you talk so far, basketball was a huge part of your life, continues to be. And so as you come towards the end of your college career, you start looking around and you say, hey, I want to continue to play. So tell us a little bit about how the opportunity comes for you to play professionally. Just give us an idea of what you had to do in order to make that happen. And then we'll get into what that experience was like.
Oh man, that opportunity came from us being really good at Xavier. you know, when you sit at number three in the country and you play with people that make you look good, you know, that opportunity comes. But also, you know, obviously the hard work I had to put in the work to put myself in position to, you know, to play the minutes that I was capable, you know, able to play and to be the teammate that I was and to do the things that I was able to do. Just the hard work and dedication, the blood, sweat, and tears that go into becoming someone that can compete at the professional level. You know, that's just hard. But, you know, when I'm honest, man, again, I played with people that made me look great.
Yeah, that's a great lesson for any player who might be out there listening, that so often, especially in today's culture, it's such a me culture. And to hear you say that, yeah, I accomplished a lot, but I only accomplished a lot because my teammates were there to make me look good. I mean, I think if all of us could adopt that mentality, not just in basketball, but you think about in life, how many people try to grab credit for doing this or doing that instead of looking around them at the people, whether it's their family, whether it's their coworkers, whether it's whoever that has supported them and helped them and gotten them to the position that they're in. I think that gratitude that you have is something that if we could transfer that to everybody in every walk of life, we'd all probably be a lot happier and a lot more well-adjusted society than we are at times.
When you're trying to win and trying to be successful, you don't care who get the credit. You
know,
at the end of the day, when the goal is common and you have a goal, you know, and everybody's on the same page, it doesn't matter who get the credit. You know, I'd rather win a championship than score 20 points. You know,
yeah, go ahead.
No. I just was saying I'd rather win a championship. I'm more satisfied with having four rings from Xavier than you know, any accolade that I carry.
Yeah, I think that's something that, unfortunately, the way that our society is set up, and it goes back to that youth basketball culture. Hey, hoopheads. We all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E. And use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's ARYSE.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off. This was the point that I wanted to make back when we were talking about this that kind of slipped my mind as we were talking. But I think one of the things that I see with players and their families in a lot of cases is they're so focused on the next opportunity that's going to come along that they lose sight of the moment that they're in. In other words, when I'm an elementary school player, I'm thinking about, well, I got to get on this AAU team, or I can't wait till I can play for my school and be a starter. And then when I get done with middle school, I want to be on the varsity right away. And if I'm not on the varsity, then I'm going to transfer. And then when I'm on the varsity, I'm not really enjoying my time playing high school basketball because I'm worried about, am I going to get a scholarship and where am I going to go to school? And then even if I get to college, I'm like, well, I'm not scoring enough points, or I got to get an opportunity to play professionally. And by the time I turn around, my time as a player is over. And as a parent, this is something that I didn't understand until I had my own kids and kind of had them going through it. It just goes so fast. And if you're focused on what's going to happen next year, then you miss what's right in front of you. And I think that what you've been talking about, the theme of celebrating your teammates and recognizing the contributions that they've made and just enjoying being with them and trying to have success as a group, as a team, not as an individual, to me, that really is what is the beauty of basketball. And that's when you look at the players, the teams that are most successful, is they figure out a way to make it a team. And there still may be a star player. There still may be one player who is better than the others or stands out more than the others. But on the best teams, everybody finds a way to pull that rope in the same direction. I think that's what you're describing.
Absolutely.
So talking about Finland, tell me a little bit about what that was like. You go out of the country, you're in a whole different culture. What was that like, not only playing, but also just living in a foreign country for, again, a kid who's 20, 22, 23 years old at the time?
Oh, it was cold. Finland was cold. But I enjoyed my time there. I actually had, you know, one of my teammates actually played, not for the same team as me, but in the same area. I lived in Helsinki, and I don't remember where she lived, but we ended up playing against each other. And you know, it was a bunch of people over there that we had had already played against when I was at Xavier. Rashonda McCants and Vanessa House, you know, all of those young ladies were there as well. And so it was cool. I mean, we would, you know, get together. I know one of my teammates, she came and visited and things like that. But obviously moving to a different country, it's a culture shock. You know, I try to tell people there's a difference between visiting and living. You know, you visit in for a week or two or whatever, it's totally different than living somewhere for 9 months, you know, by yourself and in a different culture, seeing different things. You know, it's fun, but that, you know, that too wears out. You know, you know, the whole sightseeing and all that, there's only so much sight you can see. And so it's I don't know, it wears on you. It wears on you. But I mean, I wouldn't change the experience for anything.
Was that being by yourself piece of it the hardest?
Yeah, because Finland was different because they speak their own language. It's not like French, Spanish, you know, things people, you know, that's typically taught in school where, you know, it's easier to kind of catch on to. They speak Finnish, and so that language is just so hard to learn. But fortunately, you know, with my team and everything like that, there's translators and, you know, people that spoke English and everything like that. So it was a great experience.
All right, I know. This is my standard question to anybody who's played overseas.
Mm-hmm.
What is your craziest European basketball story? Because everybody has some kind of goofy something that went on, whether it's with the fans, whether it's with team management, whether it's with coaches. I know there's something. So give us your best one that you can share on the pod.
Oh, I plead the fifth. No, I'm joking. I think, like I said, when I got to get together with a few friends and we actually got to hang out on an adult level, I think that's probably the best part about being over there, because you're in a different country, but you still get to hang with some of your friends, and so y'all should get to share that experience together. I think that's, you know, that makes for the best part without me going into the craziness on the podcast.
Understood. Enough said. All right. So as you start to look ahead while you're there playing in Finland for a couple of years, when does coaching come onto your radar? Was it something that you had been thinking about while you were playing, or was it a case where you finished playing and you looked around and you said, well, I don't know if I want to get a regular job. Basketball's been so important to me in my life. I think I better figure out a way to stay in the game. Was it more of a long-term plan, or was it more of a, hey, I got to figure this thing out because I want to stay in basketball?
No, I knew I would coach when I was a player. I was one of those players where I felt like I've done everything I needed to do with basketball. I played at the highest level. So for me, I didn't want to play another 10 years. I knew I would coach as a player, and that's why, you know, I did the So You Want to Be a Coach program and kind of laid that foundation, you know, for myself before I went to Europe. And then that way, when I came back, you know, it was already, you know, I hit the ground running. And another fortunate thing, obviously, is when you build those relationships with your coaches and things like that, you come back and get an opportunity. You know, Mike Bradbury was the head coach at Morehead. He was an assistant at Xavier, and then he got the head job at Morehead State. But then he left there and became the head coach at Rice State. And that's actually where I started my career at. You know, I came, you know, called Kevin McGuff, made some calls, and boom, when I knew that it was time to hang it up, I wanted to hang it up. You know, he gave me an opportunity. And so, you know, it for me, it was always in the works.
All right. So explain to me what the program is that you mentioned that you participated in before you went to Finland, because there may be some people out there like myself who aren't familiar with that.
It's called So You Want to Be a Coach. It's done by the WBCA each year. And, you know, you have to submit a essay, you know, explaining, you know, why you want to do it and why they should pick you and things like that, because they only pick a handful, I think it's 24 candidates. I want to say it's 24. I'm not sure what that number is. And so, you know, I did that, and, you know, it was something I went through the school and you know, through my coaches and everything like that, and kind of met phenomenal people in that program. And it is hosted at the Final Four. And so you go to the Final Four, you go through, you know, you have your itinerary of when you're going to meet and all those things. And, you know, they have some amazing speakers on the panel. You know, that's where I met LaChana Robinson, who I think highly of, who does, you know, broadcasting at a high level on the women's side. And also, you know, she's done a lot of things for the women's game. And you just meet people. You meet a ton of people, and you learn so much about the behind the scenes things and about basketball, and, you know, you network, and, you know, lo and behold, sometimes those are the people that give you an opportunity.
So when you get the opportunity at Wright State, and that program sounds fantastic, and I think that's something that, you know, you talked about earlier, coaches certification. I mean, what better way to prepare a group of young women to go into the game as coaches by, one, exposing them to all that knowledge and just all those people that can serve as mentors and sounding boards and everything that goes along with that, that we all know are critical to your success as a coach. So when you get to Wright State and you actually get to start being a coach, what was that like from this standpoint? Was there anything that surprised you about coaching that maybe you didn't realize before getting into it? And then two, what was it about coaching that you knew you loved immediately?
Well, I already said, you know, my technical title was not coach, but just to be in the atmosphere of where I can learn and be around, you know, the game and, you know, working out the players and, you know, getting to work with the players and things like that, and kind of get my foot in the water from that standpoint, learning video, learning synergy, learning the ins and outs and the behind the scenes of coaching, because it's so much more that goes into it than just, hey, you go to practice and you go home. You know, if you think that that's it, then you have been misguided. And so just being able to, you know, get my feet wet and seeing all of that and start to kind of sit down, study the game, learn the game, and move from there.
All right. So you're in that, you start getting into coaching, you start looking around for opportunities, as you said, to learn the game, to get more involved in the coaching profession. What do you remember that first year? A couple things that you took away from that first season that you're still carrying with you as a coach, things that made an impression on you that continue to impact your coaching career today?
That was a good year. I mean, that was the first year that Wright State had ever made it to the NCAA tournament. It was the first time they had won the conference championship. So it was a good year. It was a great year. I learned a ton. I think, one of the people I was close with on that staff is Trina Merriweather, who's actually the head coach at Wright State now. She was an assistant then. But just, watching how she was recruiting coordinator, watching how she, how she did things, how she talked to people, just kind of picking her brain. And she was one of the ones that I talked to a ton, and just trying to build myself up and learn.
All right. So from Wright State, your next opportunity is at Augusta. Talk about how that opportunity came to you and then what your experience was like at Augusta.
Well, that opportunity came because it was something that had opened up, and I wanted to be on the floor. And I think, for me to learn even more was for me to be on the floor. And so I knew that I had to, find a way to get an actual titled assistant position so that I could be on the floor. Augusta was different because it was almost like just I got thrown into the fire, at the Division II level. It's the head coach and it's an assistant coach. It's not all the, at the Division I level where you have three assistants, a head coach, you may have graduate assistants, you may have managers, you have video coordinator, director of basketball operation, all those things. And at the D2 level, that assistant is all of those things. And so, just that made me learn even more. I had to learn offense, had to learn defense, learn scouting, learn, community outreach, community service, academic liaison. So you wear so many different hats, and it just kind of forced me to have to learn things.
Do you think if you had stayed at the Division I level and sort of worked your way up through, again, the administrative assistant position, the director of basketball ops, video coordinator, those kinds of things, if you had worked your way through all those jobs and still not been able to get on the floor, like, do you feel like that the jump to Division II accelerated your growth as a coach and ultimately is going to benefit you and is benefiting you in your career?
Yeah, because in those positions, you're not on the floor. You can say what you want about, hey, you can sit and watch. It's one thing to watch, and it's another thing to have to actually present. When you're a coach, you have to display, demonstrate. You have to be able to communicate. You have to be able to pour in to your players, as a video coordinator and, director of player basketball operations and administrative assistant, all that. You're not on the floor. You can see what's happening, but it's different when you have to actually touch it. It's different, to say, hey, the stove is hot. Yeah, I can see that it's hot, but I don't know how hot it is. And put your hand over the fire. You can feel that burn. There's a difference. And so Division II, I think that was the best decision I've ever made. Because like I said, I had to wear so many different hats. I do not believe that I would have had the opportunity to learn and grow as fast as I did without going that route.
What's something that you weren't very good at in that position at first that you feel like over the course of your time there that you got better at and improved?
Oh man, the administrative side. There is a ton of paperwork involved in coaching, from transcripts to, evaluating transcripts to, making sure the academics is on point to getting kids in. And there's so much administrative work that goes into coaching, and you have no idea until you're actually in it. And so I think that was the biggest adjustment for me was the administrative side.
Yeah, I can see where, again, when you are as a kid, as a player, when you think about being a coach, you think about the things that you mentioned right off the top, which was you think about, I go to practice, I go to the games, and it's all basketball all the time. And that's what you think as a player. And then when you actually become a coach, you realize that only a small percentage of what you actually do is
on the court,
is basketball stuff on the court, right? There's so many other things that are also still critically important to your success. I think sometimes even when people who get into coaching, sometimes when you realize how much of that other stuff that you have to do, it's easy to think, well, maybe that stuff's not as important. In a lot of cases, it's just as important as what you do on the floor, because in order to build a successful program, you have to have all those systems in place in order for that to happen. And obviously, as a head coach, you have to manage all that. And then as an assistant, you have to help the head coach and fill in areas that they need filled in and help them in to do things maybe an area that they aren't as strong in, and you can provide a strength and vice versa. And it's just you want to have that kind of staff where everybody works together. And as you said, I think one of the things, it's been a theme special that's run through our podcast, is there's been a number of coaches that have come on that have said the exact same thing that you shared, which is going and working at a lower level than the Division I level really forces you to get out of your comfort zone and wear so many different hats, as opposed to kind of being just focused on, okay, I'm only the operations person, or I'm only the video coordinator, or I'm only working and seeing this one aspect of the program. And I can only imagine, just as you've said, the value that you got out of that experience. So your next experience is at Flagler. Talk to me about, again, how that experience, how that came to you, and then what your year was like while you were there.
Well, that came to me because Nate Teamer, I love that guy to death. We worked together 3 years at Augusta. His wife is high up in her job at PNG, and she ended up getting, you know, they ended up getting relocated. And, you know, obviously there's a decision there. Do I stay here or do I go with my wife? And if you're smart, you go with your wife.
Right, yeah, for sure.
And so that's, you know, that's the decision that he made. And so I had been knowing Erica Lang Montgomery through the conference. And she was just, you know, a heartfelt woman, you know, kind of every game we kind of, you know, had conversation, and she was just phenomenal. And I think what really like solidified the deal for me was, you know, an unfortunate situation had occurred. My grandmother had passed, and I was still at Augusta, and Erica Lang Montgomery sent me a card. Mind you, we talk at games. We never really talked on the phone and things like that. But for me, for somebody to take time out of their day to reach out to you, and we don't have a relationship to where we're talking on a daily basis and things like that, and to send, you know, her support and condolences and things like that, man, when the opportunity came for us to work together, to me, you know, for me, it was a no-brainer. You know, we shared like-minded goals, and, you know, myself wanted to go somewhere, and, you know, she was at a point, you know, at her head coaching career where, you know, she was making a turn, you know, with her program, and just to help her go and be able to help her do that, you know, in that just that 1 year, man, I wouldn't change that either.
Yeah, I think when you can find somebody who you can learn from and that you have a good relationship with, it's so valuable. And we've talked to coaches actually that have had both experiences, where sometimes you get and you're working with somebody who it turns out that you really click and you work really well together. And then we've had coaches on here who have kind of almost gone the opposite, where they've worked for somebody and they've learned a lot of things that, hey, you got to learn from what you don't want to do as well sometimes in certain cases. And so it's just interesting to hear as people go through their story and go through sort of the chronology of their careers and what they learn and what they pick up at each stop. And then your last stop before Monteverde is at the University of Illinois Chicago. And so now you're back at the Division I level. What's that like? Just tell me about what your experiences are like as a University of Illinois Chicago Flame.
You know, every experience I had has been different and unique, because every person I've worked with has been different and unique in their own way. I had been knowing Tasha Pointer for a very long time. Like I said, she was an assistant at Xavier and part of that recruiting process of recruiting me to come there. And so she, you know, she had been around in the business, heavily respected, like a mentor to me. You know, we would have conversations, you know, periodically and things like that as I was, you know, coming up in the business. And, you know, she's someone that, you know, I was looking up to, and someone that, you know, I respect and still respect to this day. And so she got the head coaching job at UIC, and you know, she gave me the opportunity to join her and come work with her.
Any difference in the different levels that you've coached at, in terms of, obviously there's a difference in the job descriptions and depending on what your title is and what you're doing from that standpoint, but just in terms of when you're coaching different levels of players, is your approach as a coach any different whether you're coaching Division One or you're coaching Division Two or you're coaching at the high school level? Does your approach as a coach change other than maybe having to adjust just to the age of the players when you're talking about high school versus college?
No. I think that, you know, obviously each level is a little different. And when I say different, as in, yeah, you may have more of an elite player who skill-wise, but you still have all the same problems, you know?
For sure.
The problems are the same at every level. You run into, like I said, whether it's academic or whether it's administration or whether it's, you know, what have you, you run into the same problems at every level. I didn't approach it as, oh, this isn't Division II, this is Division I. And, you know, the only difference is you're recruiting a different type of kid.
Hey, coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website, and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season, and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit SnapRaise.com, and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time. When you have and you figure out your approach as a coach and you figure out what you want to do and what's important to you and how you go about doing it, then I think there's some universal truths to coaching that if you have your beliefs and you have a system and you have the way that you want to interact with kids and you want to build the relationships like we talked about earlier, then those lessons are going to apply across whatever level you're coaching. And again, whatever age of kid, if you just make some slight adjustments to dealing with whatever's going on in their life outside of the game, then you can have that impact that you want to have. So you obviously spend the beginning part of your career as a college coach, and now you're coaching at the high school level at Monteverde. You go from being an assistant coach to a head coach. So there's two transitions there in this new position that you're in. So I don't know which one you want to tackle first, going from an assistant coach to a head coach or going from the college to the high school level, or maybe weave them both into one answer. But what's the experience been like so far in this new position with this new opportunity?
The experience has been great. You know, I weave them into both because my coaching experience at the collegiate level, I think, is what really has, you know, prepared me for what I'm doing. I know oftentimes people think that going and coaching at different places is a bad thing. But for me, I think that was a great thing because I think that some coaches stick with one coach. You know, say you're an assistant, you're with the same head coach for 10 years, right? You're only learning one way. You know, you're learning how that specific person likes it and how they want it and how they see it. You know, I was fortunate enough to be a part of different programs. And like I said, in, you know, earlier, each coach was different. Their style was different. So uniquely, I learned different style, different coaching methods, whether it's offense, defense. You know, there were lessons there. So, you know, now that I transitioned into a head coach here, you know, I kind of was able to take from each one of those coaches, you know, what I thought suited me and able to put all that stuff together and mold myself as a head coach. And I think that has been like the biggest blessing for me at this position.
When you think about being a head coach and going into Monteverde, what would you say was your number one priority when you got there as a head coach based on what you had learned at your other stops? What was the thing that you said, if we're going to have the type of success that I want to have as the head coach, that I have to establish this or I need to do this? What was the number one thing that was on your agenda when you got the job?
Well, my number one thing on the agenda when I got to Montverde was to get to know the players. that's number one. Obviously, you have to gain the trust and respect of the people you're going to coach. You know, if I come in the door guns blazing, hey, this is my way or the highway, that type of attitude, you know, it's already hard when people have to transition into playing for someone else, you know, let alone a different style, you know, a different different personality, a different, you know, difference is sometimes it's hard to adjust to different. And so my number one thing was to just come in and get to know these young ladies before I laid any basketball, you know, rules, or I don't even say rules because we don't have rules, but any basketball philosophies or anything down.
Do you have to go into the Monteverde community, the school community, and maybe sell your program is the wrong way of saying it, but just get people to understand what you're all about, what your program is going to be all about? Obviously, that's a very unique situation for people who maybe aren't as familiar with the Monteverde, you know, just the way that it's set up. And maybe you could speak to that a little bit just for people who are unfamiliar with that. But did you have to go out to the community, the school community, and talk to people about, hey, this is the kind of program that we're going to try to put together here?
No. I think what I did was, well, I kind of sold myself to the president who bought me.
there you go. That's the most important, right?
Yeah, that's the most important part. I sold myself to him and the AD and, you know, everybody that was involved in the hiring process. But I think, honestly, I don't think you have to sell a good product. I think that when you have a good product, you know, and you distribute it the right way, people want to buy it. And so my whole thing was just coming in and kind of getting our product together. I can't sell something that, you know, if I don't know if it's good or not. You know, a lot of times people try to sell stuff that's not good, you know, and it's the same thing as, you know, when I talked about being a player. You got to get good before you get seen. And so I never wanted to put too much pressure on the young ladies that was here, or even pressure on myself by saying, hey, this is what I'm doing. This is Now, granted, yes, I have goals. Obviously, as a head coach, I have goals. But I didn't apply that pressure on these young ladies as, hey, this is what we need to do. You know, this is it. This is the end all be all. It's not that. And so for me, the important part is getting my product good. And I, you know, good salesmen, they are, you know, when the product's good, you making money off the product. You really ain't selling nothing because people want to buy it because it's good.
For sure.
So, yeah, you know, less of me trying to sell anything and more of me trying to make sure the product is great.
So as you're putting that together and you start thinking about what it's going to look like and what you want it to be, what was the thing, I guess this is a two-part question. What was the thing that as a head coach you felt the most confident in your ability to do? And then on the other hand, what was the thing that you were maybe the most nervous about stepping into a head coaching role for the first time?
I will honestly tell you, like, I'll answer the second question first.
Okay.
I was not nervous. And I say that like wholeheartedly because the resources that Montvert provide, you know, I couldn't ask for a better administration here. Like the resources that the school provide and the support from everybody at the school, like, you know, I couldn't ask for a better situation. You know, it makes my job easier when I have people that back everything that I'm trying to do, and I have people that's, you know, that's willing to provide the resources for me to navigate and reach all the goals that we have set forth. So, you know, that's, you know, I had no trouble there. Yeah. And I answered the second question first. So the first question.
The first question was, what was something that you had complete confidence in that you knew that you were going to be able to do right out of the gate?
Oh, my coaching ability. You know, I take full just pride in just, you know, being a student of the game and you know, knowing that, you know, I'm smart enough to know that I don't know enough, but I do know that I've learned a lot. And so, you know, I take pride in, you know, my coaching ability and, you know, player development. You know, those things are, you know, if I had one thing I had to bring to the table and I'm like, hey, I'm going to knock it out the park with this, is that. So yeah, man, I had no doubt in my mind because, you know, I do my homework. You know, I watch a lot of basketball. I study the game. I listen to podcasts. I'm on, you know, I listen to different panels. I'm watching different, different Zoom meetings and clinics and just everything, you know, you need to kind of just continue to grow and learn.
Who's the one person that if you have a question, if you want to bounce something off somebody, who's that first call going to?
Ooh, I have a couple people, but definitely Carla Morrow would be my first call.
And when you call up and you have a conversation with her, and what does that look like? What's the conversation back and forth? If you say, hey, I'm having this particular situation, how does she go about helping you to work through that and talk it through?
Oh, she's solution-based. She's very solution-based. And I go to her because it's going to just be full-fledged honesty. And like I said, there's a couple people I talk to. And when I first got here, she was, you know, that was who I talked to. You know, that's who I called because she's done it at different levels. You know, she's coached at, you know, she was my coach at Xavier. She was an assistant coach in the WNBA. And now she's the assistant coach at Ohio State. And so, you know, she has different, she's been at different levels. And she's seen, again, being able to see different things and having different experiences. So she's who I, you know, who I call. And she give it to me real raw and uncut.
That's good. That's what you want. You know, you want somebody who's going to give it to you straight and not try to sugarcoat it. Because we know one of the things I think that is most important as a coach is your ability to have, I don't want to say difficult conversations, but just to be able to tell the truth, whether it's to your players, whether it's to parents who are involved in your program, whether it's to your administration. I think coaches sometimes can get themselves in trouble when they're not honest about situations, and then things build up. And then before you know it, you kind of backed yourself into a corner. And the coaches that I've been around and I've known that have had success are ones that are willing to tell the truth, whether the truth is something that people want to hear or not. Has that been your experience with what you've been able to see in the coaching world?
Yeah. I mean, the only way you're going to get better is if somebody call you out on your stuff. You don't grow by, you know, everybody patting you on your back and saying, oh, you're great. You know, you don't grow like that. And so, you know, you have to, and it's for coaches to get out and do the due diligence and find people that they can have honest conversations with, you know, but it's twofold. Some people, like you said, don't want those conversations, and others that do, those are the ones that might sting a little bit, but hey, I needed to hear it, move on from it. And so I'm just fortunate enough that I do have people in my corner that's going to tell me the truth.
That makes sense. All right. So I want to flip the question around on you and ask, I know one of the things that from talking to Everest, who got us connected, he said one of the things that you're passionate about is being able to help other young women and lift them up and reach back behind you to help pull up other people behind you and get them involved in the game of basketball and just to be able to lift up young women in general. So do you have people who you are the mentor to them, and just why are you so passionate about being able to help the next generation of players, coaches, young women to help them to achieve some of the things that you've been able to do in your life?
Yeah, I like to say that I've been doing a decent job because of the relationships I have with my former players. You know, I'm still connected with a lot of them, and I take pride in forming those relationships and you know, fostering them and keeping them, you know, long lasting. And so that, you know, as a coach, that's like the best, that's the reward for me, to see them go on and become successful in doing whatever it is they may want to do, whether it's, you know, going to be a lawyer or going to be, you know, in project management or, you know, just different things, you know, just having that relationship to where, you know, my former players are still calling me. Like that's great. And just like myself, how I still talk to my former coaches.
Right.
So it's like a trickle down effect. Where I come from and the things that I went through and all those things, basketball was my vehicle and my way out. And of course, you know, I want to help the next young lady. There's plenty of people that go through the same thing that I go through. There's plenty of people that just want that opportunity. And you know, all it takes is somebody believing in them and awarding them that opportunity. I just think that's, you know, that's why I do it.
I always say that there's nothing more rewarding than getting that phone call from somebody that played for you 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and you pick up the phone and they're like, hey, coach. And you just know that you've had an impact. And a lot of times as a coach, we don't always know it in the moment because a lot of times players are so caught up in what they're doing day to day that they don't always appreciate what their coach has done for them over the course of their career. And then 2 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later, when they look back on those experiences and the lessons that they learned and just the memories that they have, and when somebody reaches out to share that with you, to me, there's nothing better than that particular moment as a coach. And I think just from hearing you talk, I'm sure that there's a lot of young women that have had the opportunity to play for you that would certainly say that same thing. I want to wrap up your special with one final question. Again, it's a two-parter. It's kind of one that we've been ending the podcast with recently. And the first part is, when you look ahead, what do you see as your biggest challenge? And then what is the biggest joy that you have in being a basketball coach? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
I think my biggest challenge for me is a goal is to kind of build and have multiple teams on the girls' side at my vert and kind of build it into like an academy, kind of something similar to like what the boys have, just to get more girls involved and have more teams, and developing more young ladies. Obviously, that's going to be a challenge because, you know, with more people comes, you know, hire more staff, you got to have more resources, those type of things. So I think that, you know, that'll be a challenge, but it's one I'm willing to tackle because it's something that I want. It's something that I want to happen. And you asked what is my biggest joy?
Yes.
My biggest joy right now is just coaching these young ladies that I have. You know, they come in and day out and they work hard for me. I couldn't ask for a better group. Especially in my first coaching job, you know, head coaching job, I couldn't ask for a better group of young ladies, you know, to kind of get my career started with me than this group that I have right now.
Yeah, I think just that day-to-day relationship with players is something that coaches always mention. And they usually say it in everybody takes kind of a different approach or, you know, shares that in a different way. But ultimately, I think that relationship with players is really what drives coaches. And the basketball piece of it clearly is very, very important. But it ultimately, as we've talked about numerous times throughout the podcast, and I think we started out here, it's those relationships that are really what makes your coaching career so valuable and so rewarding. And so many coaches have shared that with us. And I just think it's so, so critically important. And when you think about young coaches out there, so often they get into it just because of the basketball piece of it. And then as they're in it longer, they start to realize that, yeah, basketball is certainly a part of it, but it's those relationships that really drive your ultimate satisfaction as a coach. Special, I want to just say, before we wrap up here, I want to say thank you to you for taking the time out of your schedule to join us. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share where people can reach out to you, how they can connect with you, how they can connect with your program, share your social media, whatever way you feel is best for people to connect with you and find out more about you and your program. And then I'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
Absolutely, Mike. Special Jennings, you can follow our program, Montverde Academy Girls Basketball, on Twitter and on Instagram at MVAGBB. My personal accounts on Twitter, you can follow me at Special Jennings, kind of just to update, kind of stay in tuned in what we have going on. I thank y'all so much for having me. It's been phenomenal. You asked a ton of great questions, and I hope that, you know, my knowledge and my journey can shed light on some things in this industry and help the next.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun. We had an absolute blast getting a chance to talk to you, and I think learning about your background and growing up in Cleveland and just all the things that you've been able to do in the game and all the things that you're going to be able to do in the game as you continue to build and grow in your career. We're honored that you took the time out of your schedule to join us. So thank you very much. And to everyone who's out there listening, we appreciate it. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.